I started with a question. I've asked it in a few different ways. How do we support multilingualism in our largely monolingual or at least English-dominant early learning spaces? Or how do we support pre-literacy and language development in all the languages our students live in, even when not all of us share those languages? Or what is early childhood education's role in protecting children's mother tongue or home languages? Or how do early childhood educators create multilingual spaces that honor, celebrate, normalize a world of languages and dialects? How is resisting monolingualism in our classrooms or the unacknowledged normalcy of dominant American English, DAE, in a US setting, an integral part of our anti-racist pedagogy? Many questions. Hi, this is Maya, sharing some research, thinking, stories, and ideas with all of you. Thanks for listening.
Rachomin und abrei, ich will euch fragen, ich will euch fragen.
I wanted to make a resource for us at Studio, maybe also for our families, maybe more broadly as we share what we're thinking on with our colleagues at UCDS. I also wanted us to have as many voices as possible, literally. So you will hear voices from our Studio community, families and teachers, and folks from my broader community who think on, work on, or live these questions. And because resources for multilingualism should be multilingual, you will hear some of the languages from our community and some more. Some things will be translations, some will be translated, some will not. It's a start. We will have four chapters.
我们知道的事情.
What we know.
У що ми віримо?
What we believe.
Porque importa.
Why it matters.
Papilla.
What we are doing. India has 19 official languages. South Africa has 11. More than 20 nation-states around the world have more than one official language. Still, UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, reminds us monolingualism in official or dominant languages is still the norm around the world. And the choice of language in the educational system, UNESCO continues, confers a power and a prestige through its use in formal instruction. According to the Migration Policy Institute, young children growing up in households where at least one parent speaks a language other than English now make up nearly one-third of all young children ages 8 and under in the United States. The families of these dual language learners, DLLs, speak many languages and have varied countries of origin, races and ethnicities, and socioeconomic statuses. For early childhood education, schools, and other systems, this super diversity has important implications, but there has been less research about our super diverse contexts, and growing awareness has not necessarily translated into the classroom. In fact, according to the Harvard School of Education, few early childhood educators are fluent in more than one language, and few receive training in cultural and linguistic diversity. There is, of course, a long history in this country of often violently enforced monolingualism and the many myths that have grown out of that. One persistent concern that we still hear is that any significant time speaking another language, a home language, will somehow get in the way of English language learning. In fact, UNESCO summarizes current research that concludes that literacy in a mother tongue lay important cognitive and linguistic foundations for learning other languages. This is running counter to a traditional deficit view of language learning. One result of deficit views and misconceptions regarding language, Alice Y. Lee and Laura J. Hansfield write in The Reading Teacher, is that classrooms become linguistic sieves that filter out all other languages except dominant American English, rather than spaces in which students' home languages become starting points for learning. Research over the last few decades has discredited many myths, assumptions, and anxieties about language learning in early childhood. Language development is not delayed because students are learning more than one language at the same time. Monolingual and multilingual children learn words at the same rate. In fact, multilingualism has been shown to be beneficial, linked to cognitive flexibility, enhanced executive control, social perspective taking, and metalinguistic awareness. Being provided the opportunity for fluency in multiple languages from early childhood onward has resulted in better academic outcomes in all these children's languages. Denise Sullivan, who studies international schools and multilingualism, concludes, "Research shows that first language acquisition does not stop after the first 5 years. Children continue to acquire complex grammatical features and vocabulary of their first language well into the elementary school years. Few educators are aware of how fragile young children's mother tongues can be and how quickly they can lose their ability to communicate in the home language if it is neglected. Within just 2 or 3 years of being immersed in a second language, children can lose their ability to communicate in their mother tongue. This is especially true of children who do not have a strong representation of their linguistic group in the school and community. To minimize home language loss, parents need to have a strong commitment to use of the native language at home. They can also try to expand the contexts in which it is used, such as play dates, social or religious groups, extended visits to the home country, and so on. So, what does the mother tongue need to survive while a child is also learning a culturally dominant language? Studies show it takes 6 to 8 years of education in a language for academic fluency at a middle school or high school level. For mother tongue fluency to have a chance if it is not the primary language of instruction in school, UNESCO and others argue that 3 things must be true. Consistent communication in a home language with family and community on, quote, increasingly complex topics that go beyond household matters. Some form of ongoing formal reading and writing education in a home language. And finally, exposure to positive attitudes about multilingualism, maintaining a mother tongue, both because of cultural identity, but also because that's useful in your life. This is a tall order, especially for families.
And so that's what's been really hard. And it's just, I don't know, I think like getting your kid to be multilingual, especially in a setting like mine, requires a lot of patience and lots of dedication and just like lots of troubleshooting, mm-hmm. I believe. Yeah. So I don't know. I think in some ways I'm doing a terrible job at it. But in other ways, like, I'm trying as much as I can.
Nobna is a dear friend and a PhD student in the English department at the University of Washington, and we talked a little bit on the phone about her daughter Jude.
I think it's more challenging for me because I have, like, three other people in my household who only speak English. And
exactly.
So, and what was further complicated things is daycare.
Yeah.
Right? Because daycare, I get sent her to daycare, and the daycare she goes to, and they speak to the children in English. So she's getting exposed. It's not like my first year with her, you know? My first year with her, I definitely was spending more time with her than anybody else, but it's not the case anymore.
Yeah.
It's like now it's like daycare and me and...
Research shows that primary caregivers, parents, and family have the strongest influence on a child in the early years when it comes to language acquisition, and that parents share hopes and anxieties for their children's language learning. Families want their children to have what they need to get a job, to participate with dignity in their social, legal, and economic worlds. Many families have dual language goals for their young people. They want children to feel at home in broader society, and they want children to also have a connection to heritage. Researchers often talk about impact belief, to what extent families, parents, believe that they can really have an impact on their child's language development, if they can actually realize these dual language goals. And not surprisingly, families who really have a sense that the choices that they make for their children will make a difference are more successful. How can schools then, and particularly early childhood education, support families in the hard work that must happen at home and must be reinforced in other parts of a child's life, including school and daycare? What is our role in helping to cultivate a school community full of families who have strong impact beliefs around their child's multilingual future?
Atfar, what is perceived in Arabic? It's like yaraun. من منذ نعومة أظافرها أن اللغة اللغة التي يستخدمونها تختلف.
Kids know.
Yeah, they do know.
Dessa barnen kommer till skolan med en värdefull gåva, deras modersmål.
So, it matters what we believe. It matters what we believe about children and what they are capable of. It matters what we believe is important, vital, what children deserve and need. We make decisions based on these values. We see things as problems or gifts based on these values. We see new possibilities or overlook them based on them. So, what could we believe? One vision from scholars Angie Zapata and Tasha Trope Lehman. What if instead of thinking about bilingual kids or multilingual kids, we thought instead about multilingual contexts and how you work in those contexts? What would it mean to help all kids deepen and broaden their linguistic toolkits, grow a multilingual context for all language learners, including those living and learning in communities where English is the dominant code of instruction? What if students did not have to encounter writing instruction informed only by monolingual values and language designations? What if instead, through the integration of families, teachers, and students' linguistic histories and the sharing of linguistically diverse experiences and literature, students composed in contexts where translingual approaches were alive, that is, normalized, studied, discussed, valued, and appropriated for all students.
The other thing is that this sort of notions of bilingualism are very much a sort of Anglophone concept.
I also got to sit down with my mom, Sandra Silberstein, professor emerit at the University of Washington English Department.
I remember somebody getting up at a conference and saying, all this discussion of the bilingual brain, he said, we should be discussing the monolingual brain because most of the world's at least bilingual. I had two South African students in our program early on, and the other students said to them, like, what languages do you speak, you know, when you sit down before class starts? And they said, well, we've got five languages between us. And so we just start off in one and get as far as we can with that, and then we just keep shifting and just doing the work we need to do to make ourselves understood. And there are all kinds of issues of identity. I mean, it's not only that, you know, language is culture and it's identity and it's home and it's who you are, but then that goes to what it means to tell children, for example, that they can't use that resource that so much defines them. And so the issues of shame and trauma that go along with trying to rob kids of their either their home language or their linguistic repertoire.
El lenguaje no solo es una herramienta para la comunicación y la sabiduría, sino también un atributo fundamental de la identidad cultural y el empoderamiento. Respetar los antecedentes lingüísticos y culturales de los estudiantes en el marco educacional es crucial para fomentar la confianza en sí mismos como personas y miembros de la comunidad, alentándolos así a ser estudiantes activos y competentes.
We believe in a child's right to learn in their mother tongue, We believe in linguistic diversity, and we believe that that is part of the work of sustaining cultural diversity. We believe that the way children's home languages are treated in school is part of maintaining power structures that manufacture marginalization and minoritization, and what UNESCO calls the unfulfilled promise of children's rights. We also believe that this is hard to do, and it's hard on families.
Yeah, and you know, there have been several graduate students who've tried to do research on themselves and what it means to raise a bilingual kid, and it's incredibly hard. And, you know, you may decide that you're only going to speak to a kid in that home language at home, but getting them in public to answer you in that, or even to answer you, period, is just really hard. You know, the U.S. is just so good at extinguishing languages and getting people to assimilate. And, you know, and there was an Americanization project that was active starting at the turn of the 19th century. To this day, kids get that message and they don't want to be different. And it's very hard for parents to maintain it. I think that increasingly people are doing it, you know, and certainly, you know, in the academy, people who study language, I mean, you know, I'm seeing more and more people where their kids are, you know, at least bilingual, and they've like persuaded their kids that that's the bomb. And, you know, they're really special because they can do that thing. But often it's understand but not speak.
I was wondering if you would tell the story that you sometimes tell of asking your students to
do their language histories.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what I would sometimes do is have students in groups. At one point, I came over to a group, and they were just stunned. And they were sitting there saying, there are 15 of us, and we've lost 16 languages among us. And one of the models that we talk about is, you know, is language a problem or a resource? And what would it mean in the U.S. if we saw multilingualism as a resource, as opposed to being a society that's so particularly effective at assimilation and language loss?
There was some research years ago where...
I also spoke with my cousin, Marissa Rolnick, Professor Emerit at Witwatersrand University in South Africa.
You know, Indians came to South Africa in the 19th century to do indentured labor. They were put in Indian suburbs, Indian townships, but they came from different parts of India. So what happened was that the wife couldn't speak to the neighbor because they spoke a different language. And taking that a generation on, there were grannies in the house who couldn't speak to anybody except their family, and even their grandchildren were losing the language. And so they found that these people's vocabulary had dropped to about 300 words, you know. And, you know, like modern-day Indian South Africans often can't speak any Indian language. So it's that kind of thing that one's got to work against.
What is important about Arabic remaining one of her mother tongues?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, for one, I think that, you know, for me, the priority is her communicating with my family, right? And her, like, having connection to my heritage. That's, like, the main thing for me. And then, obviously, there's all the other things, which, like, you know, research shows that children who are multilingual are way more flexible, more open-minded, and, you know, like, you have all the research that, like, focuses on job markets, right? And, like, having two languages and how that helps you with the job market. I don't really care that much about that. But in the end, I think, like, for me, her learning Arabic has always been about her being able to communicate with my family. I mean, my grandmother doesn't know English. So, and I feel like she won't really have that much of a connection to Palestine if she doesn't know Arabic, right? Even if she has a connection to Palestine, I think, like, she wouldn't have that much of an appreciation of certain things. She doesn't know Arabic. And so priority for me is my heritage, right? It's,
yeah,
like keeping that connection, keeping that aspect. I think that identity does have something to do with language, right? And so keeping that alive.
چی کار داری میکنی؟
So, what are folks doing? We are not many of us in a context of scarcity or disadvantage. We have such a rich linguistic context, and we teach and learn in a program where all of our children do not lack fluency in the dominant language of instruction. But what are we doing to actively support and value the same amount of fluency in a mother tongue or other home languages that are not English? And part of that is how to support families to figure out how to do that and prioritize that in a doable way, especially in contexts when English, for example, is a meaningful and lived language in the family, perhaps the language that is shared by all the members in the family. It's also a tricky time for families. It feels like a vulnerable time to early questions of development. It is very hard to get over that hump, because the fear is very real, and you want to connect with your kid and for them to flourish.
The assumption that language is a resource and people's full linguistic repertoire is a resource, and that you can use that in order to both communicate as well as learn academic skills and learn languages. So translanguaging, and this is Nancy Buayash's work, is encouraging students to use their full linguistic repertoire to express themselves in writing often, and then to have them think about why they wrote that in that language and why they wrote the other thing in another language.
In my own research, I found a handful of compelling stories from classrooms around the country creating rituals, projects, and practices of translanguaging. At the elementary level, I read about classrooms where students wrote book reports in their home languages about English texts that the whole class had read. Leanne Hansfield wrote about remixing texts for academic purposes, or mashups of books, songs, photos, and other literacy tools to include more than one language in the community. One early elementary classroom wrote Mother's Day cards in both English and the children's mother tongue. These are all classrooms where teachers did not speak all of the languages of their students, but partnered with families and did the research necessary to support the children's work at a comparable level to their English literacy. At the preschool level, I read of a classroom that gave cameras to students to take home and photograph their home lives. They then orally captioned the photos in English and their home languages, and teachers used ebooks and iPads to link the photos with the audio caption. The ebooks could stay on the bookshelf of their classroom, and students could read in other languages by listening to the captions of their peers. These are classrooms trying to create what E. Brooke Chapman D'Souza calls a classroom ecology that celebrates diverse contributions. One where children discover that there are numerous ways of describing the world, not only outside of school, but inside an educational context. These are teachers who are finding meaningful ways to use technology and other resources, other folks in the community who are native speakers and languages of their students, to provide suggestions, support, visits, so that the burden of representation is not just on multilingual families who also have incredibly busy lives. In their article, I write to show how beautiful my languages are. Zapata and Lehman share steps towards a translingual approach, where educators actively work with and learn from community members in order to deepen understandings of the languages and literacies in their lives, as well as reflecting openly on their own language histories. Here is the list that they made of things we can do. Grow your home, school, and classroom libraries to include culturally and linguistically diverse literature. Engage families in ways that bring families into the classroom, as well as make visible children's learning so it can be reinforced in other languages at home, and in ways that are easily shareable with family who live abroad. Intentionally teach metalinguistic awareness by drawing students' attention to languaging moments in the classroom. So noticing differences and similarities in how different languages work, sound, look, how we use different languages for different things sometimes, that some of us speak languages throughout the day that are not English, make it visible and something that they can learn to notice and unpack. Collaborate with colleagues to unpack their linguistic histories and find ways to share that as a resource in the classroom. support families' commitments to speak to their children in their home languages, become a language ethnographer, complete a survey with colleagues and or your students about the languages that are spoken in your community. Enjoy and closely study linguistically diverse literature for the artful ways authors write across their languages for multiple purposes, including as activists. So, imagining together, what if resources about creating a multilingual classroom culture were provided to all parents when they enrolled, along with specific resources about the benefits of supporting mother tongue literacy to those who wanted them, debunking common myths and providing resources for families who have decided to raise bilingual or multilingual kids, including things like social media and local meetup groups of families trying to do the same thing. New family surveys could ask for high-frequency words and phrases in home languages and English dialects, as well as questions that help families map their child's language environments. What if children's water bottles and cubbies had their name in all their languages, and teachers were taught how to write them as well, and other print materials and signage was not only in English? What if classroom songs that give us a sense of shared community were in all of our languages as well? And what if our use of technology helped us provide language exposure that we could not provide otherwise? What if we developed a school-wide language policy, a touchstone to serve us in value-based decision-making, and a way to communicate and demonstrate to parents that we value multilingualism and mother tongue development? What do we believe about mother tongue and native language use in school? Denise Sullivan writes, "It is not enough to just celebrate and encourage linguistic diversity. We must also make use of students' mother tongues as a tool for learning both English and academic content. In a school with a clearly articulated language policy, we would not have one classroom that welcomes native language use. Having a language policy will help us guard against the potential inconsistencies. What if we continued to create classroom environments where we notice the beauty in other languages and the cultures they sustain, and speak regularly about the benefits of speaking, understanding, and recognizing other languages that are not English, where we learn as much as we can about students' languages, dialects, family culture, learn basic greetings and high-frequency words so that we can understand and use them with that child and teach them to other children, normalize and celebrate using each other's languages, where we encourage families to share books, songs, poems in home languages, and find ways to have them live for longer than one visit in our classroom. What if we celebrated International Mother Tongue Day on February 21st each year? Basically, what if we kept building on what we're already doing?
She lost her voice and she didn't talk anymore.
I ended up subscribing to this thing called Arabic Book a Month.
Ooh.
And so, yeah, so it's a little bit pricier than I would like it to be, but they send you a book every month. You could do like 2 books a month or 3. It's been really great. Like, I've actually loved the latest one they sent us was a book in Arabic about potty training. And it's perfect timing. Perfect timing.
That is so perfect.
Yeah, because she's starting to indicate, you know, she wants to pee or she wants to go. Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
If you can make something like that work, it's really great.
Thanks for listening.